Hello, junkies. Welcome to the Nocturnal Throwback Podcast, where we repodcast the original 2007 version of Nocturnal, the one where I wrote and podcast a chapter every week. Yes, this is the book that went on to become the hardcover release from Crown Publishing in 2012. We have a sponsor for today that wants the ad in the middle of the episode. They are quite particular about their various requests, so we aim to comply. It will only be a brief interruption in the story. You know, like commercials on that old-timey non-streaming TV thing. Remember those? As usual, I am juggling a lot of things, but we are making great progress on GFL6, The Gangster. Hardcover and audiobook cover art is in the works. The final copy edit is back. It won't be long now. And wow, do we ever appreciate your patience. We really, really, really do. Here we go with the original talkie talk from Nocturnal episode number 27, and then your sexy, sexy episode of the throwback. Get it? And welcome to the free podcast novel Nocturnal. This is episode number 27.
Man, that's a lot of episodes.
Nocturnal is a podcast-only novel. You can't buy in stores, and you can't peek at the end. Written and performed by Scott Sigler. More information and more free stories available at scottsigler.com. This book contains adult language, mature situations, and lots of violence. Hello, junkies, and here we go with Nocturnal, episode number 27. The story's really starting to come together, and I think we're going to be done on episode number 30. Might be one extra. Sometimes I lie. I'm not really sure. I'm back from a week's vacation in Yosemite. I will have a little bit of video coming up for you guys on that in the coming weeks. Make sure you stay tuned to the end of episode number 27. We've got promos from BJ Harrison's Classic Tales podcast, the patio book Singularity, and UC Radio, a rocking pod-safe music show. I've got a big old fat 37 minutes of story for you here, and let's get into the story so far.
This is Sheila D. from OnTheCreativeSide.com. I don't want to bore you with the stuff about me, so I'll dive right in with the story so far. San Francisco homicide detective Brian Clauser and his partner Pookie Chang talked to Aggie James, a bum who was found in the San Francisco subway system carrying a baby wrapped in a blanket decorated with the symbols of the cult known as Marie's Children. Aggie also had a list of addresses, a list that included the address of Roberta Dubravtichuk, the mother of murder suspect Rex Dubravtichuk, as well as the address of one John Clauser, Brian's father. Brian took the blanket and left Aggie's room. Russian gangster Pavel Fatboy Rachmanov was wounded in a gunfight between Dmitry Vasilov and mafia kingpin Frank Lanza. Pavel needs medical attention, but will that lead to trouble for Gennady Ivanovich, Dmitry's right-hand man? Retired homicide detective Francis Parkmeyer helped Brian and Pookie with their investigation, but that help did not go unnoticed. Subchief Sean Robertson was working with Lanza and now is working directly with Marie's Children. Robertson identified many risks to the secrecy of Marie's Children, including Brian, Pookie, medical examiner Robin Hudson, and Francis Parkmeyer. Rex told Robertson that all of those problems need to be eliminated.
Brian Clauser stood next to a tiny bed covered with a clear plastic hood. Inside was a sleeping baby. Skin a smooth, deep black. Little eyes closed. Just a few strands of curly, corkscrew hair sticking out of his head. But looks didn't matter. What mattered was the feeling in Brian's chest. The same feeling he'd had when he saw Marco Gastineau. Marco Gastineau, who paid cash for everything, who seemed to have no actual record of ever having existed. The same feeling he'd had when he saw Jebediah Erickson. Right before Jebediah Erickson freaked out, started calling him Satan. Brian walked away from the baby. He had everything he needed, or rather, he'd felt everything he needed to feel. He pulled out his cell phone and called Robin. She answered on a second ring.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Not good. You, pick up that thing from the place?
Yeah. The thing. Exactly. We got it. Where are you now?
We're at the morgue.
If I drop you off some samples, how fast can you run them?
For the Zet?
Yeah.
Well, right away. Stone's with me. We're prepping the thing to run it right now. We can run both samples at the same time.
You'll be running four, not two. And I need you to call me the second they're done.
Brian, you sound weird. Are you okay?
No. I'm pretty fucking far from okay. Meet me in the parking lot in 10 minutes.
Apparently, San Francisco General Hospital was the place to be. First Savior, then Aggie James and the baby, and now a Russian mobster, wounded in a firefight downtown and on his way to the emergency room. More cops were also on the way to provide additional security, both to stop the mafia from trying to whack him and to dissuade the Russians from trying to break him out. The uniforms would have to handle things, though, because Pookie needed to get to Roberta Depravdichuk's house and have another talk with that ever-so-pleasant woman. Her name was on the list. So was Brian's dad, and Pookie feared he knew the reason they were both there. He checked the caller ID before answering, careful not to pick up a call from Sub-Chief Sean Robertson. Caller ID? John Smith.
Black Mr. Burns, Pookie said as he answered. Here's what I want. I want good news. My day is about as tasty as a St. Bernard turd rolled in rancid fish poon. Whatever you have to tell me now is only going to make my day better, right?
Yeah, but only if you like your fish poon turd with a side of tainted clams. I ran that murder rate report you asked me for.
Pookie sighed. Fuck it. Go ahead.
First, let me give you some perspective on the issue. San Francisco's population peaked in the 50s at 775,000. Right now it's about 767,000. Not much variation in the past 50 years, so the population is a constant against which we can evaluate murders on a fundamental one-to-one, year-to-year basis.
Do you always talk like a band nerd that played French horn?
What?
When you fuck, do you say shit like, I'm going to insert my penis now, then move it back and forth in a rapid motion until I achieve orgasm?
Yeah, but only when I'm banging your mom.
Point taken. Continue.
The highest murder rate in the past 20 years was 1993, with 133 murders. Things have been down lately. We haven't had over 100 since 1995. In 1976, there were 241 murders. That's the highest the city has ever officially recorded. And what that doesn't take into account is that they had 187 murders through June of 1976, an average of 31 a month. In July, it dropped to 19. After that, murders dropped off to 7 a month, the normal murder rate.
You're shitting me.
I shit you not, Pooks. And serial killings were up 500%. Files say that there may have been as many as 7 serial killers in action at the same time in San Francisco. That shit never got released to the press, because Mayor Moscone sat on it like a ugly fat girl riding a willing drunk.
See, now when you talk like that, it makes all this death and despair so much more fun.
I'm doing the best I can to make it more palatable.
7 serial killers,
Pookie said, feeling his nuts kind of shrivel up and look for a hiding spot somewhere in his stomach.
You're sure it wasn't just one really creative serial killer, maybe trying to express himself in a not-so-constructive way?
Oh, I'm sure. And I knew you'd ask that, so I ran Erickson's incarceration dates. Guess when he was let out of jail?
I don't want to guess, and I don't want to know.
It's okay. I'll tell you anyways. July 2nd, 1976. In that same month, murder rate went from 31 killings a month down to 19, then after that down to 7. I think we fucked up. I think we fucked up real bad, Pooks. Because if the murder rate plummeted when he was on the streets, then that means when he's off the streets...
BMB didn't have to finish the sentence. It didn't take a Mensa member to do the math. And as Pookie already knew, you can't fuck math. When Erickson was out of commission, the murder rate in San Francisco skyrocketed 400%. Pookie's fingers tapped the cell phone.
But Erickson was in for what, a year and a half? When did he go in the clink?
January 16th, 1975,
Black Mr. Burns said.
That year went by pretty much normal, although the murders went from 8 a month to 16 in November and 21 in December.
It took him a while to figure it out.
It took who a while?
Marie's children. They didn't know he was out of commission right away. They had to figure it out as they went.
That's a great guess. Maybe you should be a detective or something.
Maybe. I'll take one of those night courses.
So how is Erickson?
He's fucked up.
We gotta get him back on the streets, man. If we don't, things could get real bad.
I saw him not 30 minutes ago. The only way that dude is getting back on the streets is if I roll a stretcher down that big hill on Filbert.
Oh, I know that one. That's a 31.5% grade, you know. Steepest hill in San Francisco.
I take it back.
You take what back?
That you fuck like a nerd who used to play the French horn. You must fuck like a nerd that plays the French horn while fucking.
Only when your mom wears her earplugs.
BMB, you already went after the moms. Now you gotta find something else to insult.
Sorry, man. I'm learning.
You're doing fine, Danielson.
Both men fell silent. The jokes could only blur the fact that the city of San Francisco might be facing a massive spike in murders.
BMB, you heard from Subchief Robertson?
Yeah. Said he wants to see me when he gets back to the office. Said he has to talk to you, me, Big Tonda, and Wee Chi.
Don't see him, Pookie said. You're sick. Like, right now. Get the fuck out of there. Don't answer your phone for anybody but me or Brian. You got it?
Now that you mention it, I might be feeling the effects of some tainted clams myself.
That's the spirit. Just avoid the spunky turd side dish. Now get lost and stay lost. Before you go, look up a name for me. Marie Luttrell.
All right, who's that supposed to be?
I don't know exactly, but John Doe said she's the mother of that baby he was found with. See what you can find on her name.
All right, I got that, Books.
Pookie hung up. He realized he shouldn't have let Brian take the list of addresses. But there was one address that wasn't too far from the hospital. One address that he could visit right now. That address belonged to Roberta Dipravdichuk. Robin waited outside the San Francisco Hall of Justice. She listened to the traffic ripping by on the I-80 overpass up above. She couldn't see the cars, but they made a constant sound that reminded her of a rushing river. The parking lot for cop cars, paddy wagons, service vehicles, even meat wagons, ran under both the four lanes of I-80 heading north and the four lanes heading south. The lighting wasn't that great. A parking lot under an overpass like this would have been a scary place for a woman, were it not filled with cop cars and more than a few men and women in SFPD uniforms. Brian's car pulled into the lot. He drove into an open spot only a few feet from her. He got out of the car and opened up the back door.
What's so all-fired important you couldn't be bothered to come down to the morgue?
Just don't have time, Brian said, as he reached into the back seat and pulled out three clear, zip-locked evidence bags. One contained a nasty blanket streaked with slimy blood and covered in symbols. The same symbols she'd seen in association with the Boyko killings. The second bag contained a brown, blood-stained shirt, and the third simply contained a vial of blood.
I need these run, Brian said, holding out the bags. Right away.
He looked very, very intense. He had that blank look in his eyes again, the look like he was on autopilot, going through the motions of the job because he didn't want to let those emotions get in the way of the logic that solved cases.
We found a new way to test, Robin said. It's instant.
You're... instant?
Why, disappointed or something?
No, I just had it fixed in my mind. It would take a little while.
Well, not anymore. Stone's been working on it. The Z chromosomes have a protein that we can test for. It's not a full DNA analysis, but it does confirm whether there's a Z in the chromosome or not. Come on, if you're in such a hurry, let's get this done.
So by instant, you mean what, like an hour?
More like 15 minutes.
He held the bags out with his right hand.
Look, I need you to run these and call me with the results. I have to go somewhere, and I need the information by the time I get there.
Robin didn't take the bags. Brian gave the bags a single shake.
Now, Robin.
Robin's eyebrows went up and her hands went to her hips.
Oh, now? Maybe you should whistle or clap or maybe make me balance a biscuit on my nose.
Brian opened his mouth to speak, then stopped. He let the arm holding the evidence bag drop to his side.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was a bit demanding.
A bit?
Let me try again. Robin, would you please analyze these samples with as much haste as possible? It's rather important we find out if these samples are Zeds.
That's better, Robin said. I'll take one. I said that gets you one, Clouser.
She held out her hand. He gave her the bag holding the blanket.
That blanket was wrapped around a baby. Cops on the scene think the baby was newborn, like within a few hours newborn. Now what do I need to do to get you to take the other two bags so I can get the hell out of here?
I'll exchange bag number two for you sitting down with me for 5 minutes. She pointed to a landscape tree just to the right of where the body wagons came in to deliver corpses. She ate her lunches there. Morbid, sure, but when you've only got 15 minutes to eat, and the tree is the only greenery for miles, it doesn't really matter that it's surrounded by 2-foot-high concrete walls.
Robin, I said I was sorry. No, seriously, I have to go.
You've been going nonstop for days, Brian. Sit your country ass down and let me talk to you. Who knows? It might even have something to do with the case.
Brian stared at her for a second, annoyed, then dropped his head and shoulders in mock defeat.
Fine. 5 minutes.
They walked the 20 feet to the tree. Both turned and sat in the concrete walls. Brian's foot immediately started making patterns in the dirt and gravel sitting on the pavement at the wall's base. He handed her the bag with the brown shirt, and she took it.
What's this one?
Shirt from a suspect. He was hurt. Test it.
Robin set the bag down, then looked at him.
I know you pretty well, and I can see plain as day that something big is screwing with your mind. Something way beyond this case.
Brian stared out across the parking lot full of cop cars.
I'm just wondering who the hell I am.
What, you're soul searching? No offense, but that seems a little deep for you.
Brian shook his head.
No, it's not like that. I've been thinking back on my, I guess my career as a cop.
She didn't need to have been intimate with the guy to see that he wasn't thinking of his career in a positive light.
Thinking of all the bad guys you put away? Maybe thinking of all the families that got closure because of your work.
Brian shook his head.
Nah, nothing like that. I mean, I know what I do is good and all, but you know how some cops kill someone and it fucks with them so bad they have to quit? Or if they do stay in the force, they have to ask for desk jobs.
That's like Sasha.
Sasha, really? He killed a guy?
He shot a 13-year-old kid, Robin said. Back when he was in uniform in Pittsburgh. Totally justified shoot. The kid ignored warnings, even took a shot at Sasha. At least a dozen witnesses saw the whole thing. Sasha did what he had to do. Still, he couldn't get it out of his head. He couldn't walk a beat anymore, but he wanted to do his part, so he dropped out and became a criminalist.
Brian nodded.
I've heard stories like that dozens of times. You know what the fucked up thing is?
Robin shook her head.
I don't feel like that. Not a bit. I've killed 5 men. 5. I killed 1 to save Pookie, 1 to save Black Mr. Burns, and 3 when I saved Big Tonda Murphy. 2 of Tonda's I killed with a pipe wrench, Robin. I took him out and I didn't bat an eyelash. I've taken life 5 times, and I don't feel a fucking thing.
Robin knew of Brian's violent history. She didn't like to think about it. Didn't like to think that a man who could hold her so tenderly was capable of killing. But he was a cop, a man that had dedicated his life to the service of others.
Brian, it's not like that. I don't give a crap what anyone says. There is a difference between being a killer and being a protector. You save the lives of cops.
But shouldn't I feel something? Some kind of guilt? Remorse? Whatever the fuck those psychologists asked me if I felt after all those killings.
Brian, how about you pull your head out of your ass?
He turned and looked at her. She almost saw a smirk on his face. She didn't know what he was thinking, what he was fishing for. But the ninja didn't have one damn thing that should cause him to hang his head in shame.
Every cop on the force worships you for what you've done. You're like a superhero around here. What do you want, a sympathy card? I'm not sure Hallmark makes a sorry you don't feel bad for killing guys who are going to whack a cop. They might be too busy with Sweetest Day for that one, you think?
Brian moved the sand around with the toe of his shoe.
I hate Sweetest Day. It's a corporate travesty mockery.
You bought me a Sweetest Day card?
No fucking way.
I did? For real?
Robin smiled and nodded.
Yeah, you did. And flowers. And some candy, but you and Emma ate the whole box while I was getting ready for dinner.
Brian smiled.
Oh yeah, I remember. Peanut clusters, I think it was. Emma liked those a lot. Don't tell anyone I bought you a Sweetest Day card, all right?
Your secret is safe with me, Casanova.
Her smiles had eased the tension a little bit, but it wasn't all gone. Something was still in that head of his.
Brian, you're a good man. You hear me? You are a good man.
Brian looked up into the night sky.
A good man? Honestly, Robin, I'm wondering just what I am.
He slid off the ledge and handed her the last bag, the one with the vial of blood. She took it and set it on the concrete ledge.
Okay, I'll take care of this one too. Who's the blood from?
It's from the baby the bum brought in. We need to know, for sure, if this sample has Zed. Just run the tests, okay? Call me as soon as you get the results.
Robin slid off the concrete as well. She took one step forward, grabbed Brian's face, and pulled him in for a kiss. She meant it to be a short kiss, maybe a supercharged peck on the lips. But as soon as she connected, it turned into a real humdinger. Her arms locked around his neck, holding him in for the romantic equivalent of a headlock. Brian pulled back for a second, then gave in, and gave back in kind. He wrapped his arms around her back and lifted her up like she weighed all of 5 pounds. Maybe she had some saddlebags growing back there, but Brian made her feel as light as a little doll. He set her down in slow motion, the kiss's intensity dialing down the closer she came to the ground, until their lips parted just as her heels hit. Her hands stayed locked around his neck.
I bet you do that to all the homicide detectives.
She looked up into his eyes.
Brian, enough with the one-liners. I'm not Pookie.
No, you're not. He kisses with more tongue.
I said, knock it off, Brian.
He looked at her, then nodded.
I'm not playing this stupid game anymore. I made a mistake letting you go. I fucked up and I realize it, but that's over. Here's the bottom line, Brian Clauser. I love you. I have from the first moment you asked me out. I should have realized that instead of playing games like some stupid little girl. But all this death, this crazy shit, I'm not playing games anymore. I love you. I think you love me too, but I'm not going to push that. If you're seeing someone else, call them and tell them you're off the market.
I am?
You are.
He nodded again.
Well, I'm not dating anyone.
You don't even have a girl on the side to do the chang bang?
I can't. Pookie stole my hula hoop.
He reached up, gently grabbed her wrists, and lowered them to his sides. She held his hands. He held hers back.
Robin, I think things are going to get real bad. I've got some things I got to handle.
I don't care, Brian. I don't care how bad things are. When you're done, no matter what you have to do, I'll be here waiting for you.
She was throwing herself at him, and she didn't care. This is what she wanted. Needed. More importantly, this was what he needed, and she felt that deep in her soul. He leaned down, kissed her on the forehead, then turned and walked back to his car. She watched him walk for a moment, then gathered up the evidence bags and headed back to the morgue. She had 4 samples to run, these 3 plus the fur from the stuffed dog thing. Brian would have his results in 15 minutes. She felt so tired. Just one more pill. Her hand slid into her pocket and expertly opened up the vial of Benny's. She slipped one in her mouth as she walked back towards the morgue.
This episode is sponsored by Green Chef. Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company that makes eating well, easy, and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Meal plans include paleo, plant-powered, keto, and balanced living. Everything is hand-picked and delivered right to your door. Ingredients come pre-measured, perfectly proportioned, and mostly prepared. We tried out Green Chef. The meals were easy to make and they were delicious. Since we don't go out to dinner right now, it was great. We made the white bean burger and the Japanese fritters. Not bad! Use code SIGLER80 to get $80 off your first month plus free shipping on your first box. Go to greenchef.com/SIGLER80 to redeem for more details. That's $80 off your first month plus free shipping on your first box at greenchef.com/SIGLER80. Use the code SIGLER80. Now back to our story.
Chief Amy Zoe stormed down the corridors of the Hall of Justice, her shoe heels clicking out a fast cadence. Sasha, Sammy Berzon followed behind her, occasionally breaking into 2 or 3 steps worth of trot just to keep up. Chief Zoe had her police hat pinched under her left arm. In her right hand, she clutched a clipboard holding a summary report. 3 Russian gangsters had been taken into custody. 2 of the men had brought the 3rd to a clinic in the Richmond district. That 3rd man, wounded by gunshot, needed immediate care. Normally, the operator of this clinic, one Dr. Alexei Tamarov, would have done the surgery and no one would have been the wiser. Alexei Tamarov, however, had suffered a stroke 2 days earlier and died on the spot. His son, Dr. Yevgeny Tamarov, now ran the clinic, but he was busy attending to errands for his father's funeral. Yevgeny called his friend, Dr. Derek Sheldon, to run the clinic while he attended to the details. Any gunshot wound requires an immediate call to the police. For over a decade, Alexei Tamarov had known not to make such a call. He'd properly instructed his son that such calls were bad for business. Unfortunately for the three gangsters, however, Yevgeny had been so distraught at his father's loss and so busy with the funeral, he'd never once even thought that the one day he was out would be a day the Russian gangsters would come a-calling. Hence, no one discussed this highly illegal no-call policy with Derek Sheldon, who took one look at the wound, went into Evgeny's office, promptly called the SFPD, before going back in to treat the wounded man. The wounded man was named Pavel Rachmanov. Pavel Fatboy Rachmanov, who had been helped in by Gennady Ivanovich and Igor Stuka, both known affiliates of one Dmitry Vasilov. When the San Francisco police arrived at the Tamarov Clinic, they shipped Rachmanov to the high-security ward over at San Francisco General Hospital. Gennady and Igor, on the other hand, found themselves arrested, taken downtown, fingerprinted, identified, and then thrown into holding. Thrown into holding to await the arrival of Chief Amy Zoe, who had given express orders that no one was to talk to either of the men until she arrived. She started with Igor, only to find out that the man couldn't actually speak. Not couldn't speak English, couldn't speak as in mute. And apparently he couldn't write either. When she found out that he was known as Igor the Idiot, things made a lot more sense. So she moved on to Gennady Ivanovich. Gennady couldn't fake the idiot excuse. As rumor had it, he was Dmitry Vasilov's right-hand man. Amy walked into the interrogation room to find Gennady sitting in a chair, handcuffed to a bar connected to a scratched wooden table. She sat in a chair opposite him, while Sasha stood behind her.
"I'll keep this very simple," Amy said. "I want Dmitry, and you are going to give him to me."
"Nitka vadyu pangliski," Gennady said.
"What did he say?" Zoe said.
"He says he doesn't speak English," Sasha said.
"Get him talking. I don't care how."
Sasha nodded, then turned back to face Gennady.
«Меня ждут сейчас в баре. Значит, и бить я тридеш, насев вопросов начальника, или я приведу тебя так, как будто ты сознаешься во всем».
«Пошел на хуй», Gennady said.
«What did he say?»
«He said that he is a proud homosexual», Sasha said. «He said he wants you to make sure his court-appointed lawyer is gay, and he thinks the color blue looks fabulous with your complexion».
«I think I remember some English after all»,
Gennady said, glaring at Sasha. Sasha smiled wide.
"Ah, this is excellent."
He turned to Chief Zoe.
"Then you do not need me any more tonight. I will get out of your way."
Sasha walked to the door and left, but neither Zoe nor Gennady watched him leave. They stared at each other. Zoe with as blank a face as she could muster, and Gennady with an expression an opportunistic sex criminal might offer up to a drunken 15-year-old girl he just found wandering in a back alley at 3 in the morning.
"Let's cut the shit," Zoe said. "I want Dmitry Vasilov."
"I will not talk to you without my lawyer," Gennady said. "So don't bother making more words with those pretty lips."
"Your lawyer hasn't been called yet. You haven't been booked yet. I've already erased the time of your arrest in the records, and I'll write it in when I damn well please. This conversation we're having? It isn't happening. No one is recording anything, and everyone who has seen me here has orders to forget they did."
Gennady squinted his eyes at her and smiled.
"You are full of the bullshit. How can you do all this?"
"I'm the chief of police, you fucking moron. I can do whatever the fuck I want. Now, I've got a bar full of corpses. Three are known accomplices of yours. Two are members of the San Francisco Mafia. The other two just happened to be innocent bystanders. Yvonne Escajeda, a mother of two from Sacramento, just in town for business, and her co-worker, Bryce Hydesmith, only 23 years old. All of them dead, Gennady, because your boss Dmitry can't leave well enough alone."
"Like I should give a fuck about these people. American cities are dangerous places, always with the guns and the shooting. I am very glad I was home asleep when this tragedy occurred."
"And when we run the ballistics on the bullet in your buddy Pavel's shoulder,
When we find out that it was fired from the gun of Charlie DiPrizio or Vinny Caprice, that puts you in association with a man involved in a shootout that killed 7 people. You tried to get illegal medical attention for this man, and that makes you an accomplice.
How about you take off that police uniform? Gennady said. But do it slowly. I have fucked many Asian girls in my day. I admit that most were hookers or junkies, but I very much like Asian pussy, and this will be first time I fuck Asian super cop.
You're going down, Gennady. Maybe before you got a slap on the wrist. Maybe old man Zobakov, he paid off the right judges. But not this time. This time, 7 people died in my city. Even if you weren't guilty, the politicians want a head to put on a pike, and your smart-ass smile is what they're going to get. You give me Dmitry Vasilov, and I can make it all go away.
You give me the 69, and I can make you scream my name.
Amy leaned back and stared at the man. Pure evil. Total scum. She'd like to put a gun to his forehead and pull the trigger, but the law was the law.
I can make this bad for you, she said. So you don't talk to me? Then maybe I just spread the word that you're singing your ass off, giving us anything we want to know to stay out of prison.
Gennady laughed and slapped the table.
I like you. You sound like the cops on the television shows. You can say anything you like. No one will believe you. I am loyal to Dmitry.
Loyal enough to go to prison for him? Because once we turn in those ballistics, you're an accessory to murder. Unless you give me Dmitry Vasilov, you're either going to prison for 5 to 10, or they're putting your ass on a boat back to Russia.
In prison, I have no problem. I already spent 7 years in Russian prison, and believe me, American prison is no big deal in comparison. And besides, your people have arrested enough of us now that we are organized in your prisons. There I am safe, a celebrity even. I will be out in 3 years. Easy time. If you deport me, I go back to Russia with more information about who they can send over here, about who will fit in best with American culture. Again, I am star, and they will reward me with all the Asian hookers I can fuck. I think I will do them in the ass, and think of your face.
He leaned forward, elbows on the table, eyes sending a message that he was interested in Chief Zoe far beyond the realm of this interrogation.
You see, I have nothing to fear from you. Only thing I fear is Dmitry, our old man Zobakov. I would never betray them. And they know this, because if I did, I die and my family dies. So how do I stay alive? It's simple. I do not betray Dmitry Vasilov.
Amy stared at him for a few more seconds, then stood.
We'll let you call your lawyer. Just remember who you're dealing with. Shits like you only understand money and loyalty. All the cops who arrested you, they are loyal to me. I'm the one that signs their paychecks. So don't bother telling any of this conversation to your lawyer, because it'll only make you look like a liar.
I promise. It stays between us, my little Asian whore.
Amy smiled.
I'm going to get what I want, Gennady. If I get it from you soon, things will go better for you. If I get it from someone else, things will go much worse.
Chief Amy Zoe walked out of the interrogation room. Detective Francis Parkmeyer, retired, sat in his chair staring out the window onto Van Ness. View wasn't all that bad. Lots of people to watch, lots of cars. He'd always liked cars. When he'd been on the force, he'd treasured his 65 Vette. He'd also had that Mustang Fastback. He'd sold both cars when it came time to enter this crypt of a retirement home. The Vette to some Silicon Valley asshole. The Fastback to that one actor fellow who made the movie. He'd actually seen the Fastback a couple times down there on Van Ness. There was some traffic down there now. All kinds of cars. Even those ones that supposedly ran on electricity like something out of the Jetsons. Was that one?
The with a strange shape. It might be.
He blinked awake. It was darker out now. His chin was wet. Wet from drool, goddammit. He was like a goddamn baby. Francis picked up the napkin that was always on his lap and weakly wiped the drool away. This was what life had to offer? This was how it all ended. A lifetime of service. 2 children. 3 wives. And did any of it matter? He was a wrinkled wreck of himself. And when he dropped off asleep, sometimes he pissed himself. Sometimes he even shit himself. How humiliating was it for a grown man to wear a goddamn diaper? Francis Parkmeyer felt another slide into the unavoidable sleep and hoped, not for the first time, that maybe this would be the one sleep from which he would not awake. A weird scratching sound brought him awake. He was in bed, dressed in pajamas. The staff had done that for him. Dressed him, put him to bed, just like a goddamn baby. Maybe they'd even changed his shitty diaper. That scratching sound again. Francis looked towards the window, to the darkness of night. There was something there, a silhouette against the pinpoints of city lights. Was that a man shape? The scratching sound ended with a glassy clink. Francis blinked and tried to sit up. A hand reached through a hole in the window glass. It moved the latch, and the vertical window swung silently inwards. He watched, amazed, as a tall man slid through the narrow window. Graceful, skinny as hell, black skin rippling in the moonlight that lit up a patch of carpet inside Francis's room. Francis didn't know much these days, but he knew his room was 6 stories up, and there was no fire escape.
"How'd you do that, darky?" Francis asked.
"I flew," the man said. "More accurately, I glided." He had something in his hand, some kind of tool. He pulled off a small backpack that Francis hadn't noticed, unzipped it, and put the tool inside. He pulled out another contraption, something Francis couldn't make out until the tall man stood and moonlight hit his hands. A Smith & Wesson Model 4006, held at the end of the barrel by a vice grip with its teeth wrapped in black cloth. Francis Parkmeyer felt a surge of hope. The strangest thing, a surge of hope that this was it. That he could say goodbye to the diapers, the pissing, the shitting, the blackouts. He could say goodbye and end it all right here and now.
"You here to shoot me, darky?"
Parkmeyer said calmly. The man smiled. "Yes, I am here to shoot you. And no, I am not a darky."
"Well, you sure as hell ain't a slan, a spick, and you ain't white. So if you ain't a darky, what are you?"
The man briefly stretched his arms, and Francis saw the huge flaps of skin that ran from the inside of his arms to his flanks, all the way down to his hips. In his left hand, he held the vice grips that held the pistol. In his other hand, he held a loop of wire coat hanger. The man slid the coat hanger loop around the gun's trigger. He pointed the Smith & Wesson at Francis's head, then pulled the wire loop tight.
"Those racist names might matter to a human," the man said. "But I am not a human. I'm so much better than that. I am a nocturnal."
Francis Parkmeyer actually heard the gun fire and saw a bit of flash. He didn't really feel an impact, but something pushed his head back into the pillow. It hurt for a bit. Then the darkness gathered up again, and he slipped away. His cell phone rang. Brian didn't even bother to try and find an open space. He just pulled up to the parked cars lining the street, turned on his hazards, and double-parked. He was only 3 minutes from his destination. The caller ID said Robin Hudson. He answered.
"Yeah? Brian, you won't believe this."
Robin sounded excited. Hyper. A little too hyper. He suddenly realized that she'd been acting that way for a few days now. Acting like a tweaker. That wasn't the Robin that he knew. He'd have to deal with this later. She loved him, after all, and he'd really never stopped loving her.
"What did you find?" There was all that slime on the blanket. We've got some under the microscope and we found eggs, Brian. Human eggs. And that's pretty messed up. Because even though this was a newborn, we've already found like 5 eggs. And Stone seems to think we'll find even more. And if there are eggs in the fluid on a newborn, then the uterus must be flooded with eggs. Stone has never, never, never heard of anything like it. We're running the mitochondrial DNA test on it. And we think it's going to match the DNA of all the samples.
Which means what?
It means if we're right, the eggs are from the mother of Marco Gassino, Kyle Soler's killer, Alex Panos' killer, and the mother of your 3 samples.
Brian closed his eyes and leaned his head back on the headrest.
The mother?
Yeah. All 3 samples tested positive for the Z chromosome. So they are all Z. We're still running the mitochondrial DNA test. We suspect your samples will match earlier samples, which would mean that they all had the same mother.
Even the dog thing?
Yeah, even the dog thing.
Robin, you're sure? You're positive all 3 samples had the Z?
100%.
He took a deep breath, then let it out slow. It rattled in his lungs.
Okay, finish the rest of whatever else you're doing. I'll be in touch soon.
Brian, are you okay? Because you sound even worse than when I just saw you.
Sure, I'm fine.
He hung up. Fine was not an adjective he'd associate with right about now. The first sample had been from the blanket. The second sample was the brown shirt that Jebediah Erickson had been wearing when Brian stuck the man with his own knife. The third sample? That wasn't from Aggie's baby. The third sample was from Brian Clauser, which meant that Brian Clauser was one of Marie's children.
Well, woo, there you go. Brian now knows a little bit more of the story, perhaps part of the story he didn't want to know in the first place. A lot of you saw that coming. To some of you, finding out Brian is one of Marie's children could be a surprise. However, if you were following things over at ScottZiegler.com, odds are you weren't surprised at all, because people have been talking about that possibility in the comments on every blog post, in the forums over at ScottZiegler.com. It's been a very frequent point of discussion, which is one of the reasons to follow things over at ScottZiegler.com, even if you are getting the stories straight via your iTunes feed or your podcatcher feed. For example, episode number 27, the show notes include the links to 3 junkie names that were included as character names in this episode. It also includes links to the shows for which I'll be playing promos in just a few seconds. I will be shooting for that news episode I promised you a couple of weeks ago. Hopefully we'll get to that this week. Also, a little bit of video that I shot in Yosemite where I'm giving a shout out to all you junkies. And we deal with the latest attack by Julie Andrews. That bitch has gone too far. And before I get into the promos, a special thanks to Bill DeSmet, the author of Singularity. Bill translated the little bits of Russian that you heard in episode number 27. Then he went and recorded the lines and sent me an MP3 so that I could hack my way through some actual Russian. I have no idea what I said. As far as I know, Bill was completely screwing with me, and I said something like, in Russian, Julie Andrews is my Lord and Savior. He could have been screwed with me, I don't know. But we're going to play the promo for his book, Singularity. Also playing the promo for a music podcast called UC Radio. Mike UC focuses on heavier hard rock music, says he's a veteran of the Hollywood music scene of the 80s. So he should know what he's talking about. You might have to check that out. The first promo I'll play is from BJ Harrison's Classic Tales podcast. Now, a lot of you have never heard of this podcast because BJ has not yet immersed himself in the podcasting fiction community. However, even though you haven't heard of him, doesn't mean the show isn't huge. It has consistently been the number one fiction podcast over at iTunes. He's gotten a lot of mainstream media coverage, which has brought tons of people into his show. So check out that promo, and if you like what you hear, go check out the Classic Tales podcast. Nocturnal episode number 28 is going to be coming up in a week, and it's going to be very, very messy. It opens up with Brian Clauser having a little talk with John Clauser, the man who claimed to be Brian's father. Can you say awkward? So stay tuned for that, junkies, and I'll see you next week.
Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, Arthur Conan Doyle. These are the greatest writers of all time. Join me, B.J. Harrison, and we'll visit the worlds they created. We'll explore everything from premature burials and headless horsemen to Sherlock Holmes and potions from mad scientists. Adventure and enchantment await you every week as classic short fiction from the masters is presented complete and unabridged with professional skill on the Classic Tales Podcast. Thomas Hardy, William Shakespeare, Mark Twain, Edith Nesbitt.
What if the cataclysmic Tunguska explosion of 1908 was caused not by a meteor or a comet, but by a microscopic black hole? What if that fantastic object, smaller than an atom, older than the stars, heavier than a mountain, is still down there, orbiting deep inside the Earth, slowly consuming the planet? What if only a rookie government agent and an uncannily insightful consultant stand between a renegade Russian billionaire and his plans to use the black hole to literally change history or end it? What if it's all true? Singularity by Bill DeSmet, now available as a free podcast at podiobooks.com. Learn more at www.singularitythebook.com.
Hey, this is Mike from UC Radio, and I got a question for you. Are you tired of flipping on the radio and hearing... When? And what about this sonic nightmare?
It's the final countdown.
Then my suggestion is that you check out UC Radio at BiteMeFCC.com. That's where every song is tested and given the UC Radio seal of approval by yours truly before I stick it in your ear. Now, as a survivor of the 80s and 90s Hollywood rock scene, I've got a pretty good idea of what does and doesn't fly when it comes to the shelf life of new music. And I'm not going to play anything on UC Radio that hasn't earned the right to be on my own personal playlist. And along with great tunes in every show, you get my full frontal opinion on our world today. And once a week, I give you a classic album of Pearl to help fill in the gaps in your music collection. So check out UC Radio at BiteMeFCC.com. And as I like to say around here, volume is good, so turn it up!
You have been listening to Nocturnal, written and performed by Scott Sigler. For more information, go to scottsigler.com. All music in this podcast provided by Uncrowned off their album Devils and Angels, available now at the iTunes Music Store. Is it-